science, learning, business, community. You. Welcome to Think Works, the podcast for people who like to think. Because thinking is the hardest work there is. Come with us on a journey into the world of ideas with your host, Darren Smithson.
Hello and welcome to another episode of ThinkWorks, the place where we like to do all the heavy lifting when it comes to thinking. And this week, we're going to finally look at Philosophy 101, a beginner's guide to life, the universe and everything. And we're going to do this in three parts because some of the questions, some of the philosophical notions that we're going to be discussing can be quite heavy, and I think trying to do it all in one session would not do the particular questions justice, and also I think it might just blow my head up trying to do all of them together. So we're going to split it into three parts. I'm going to keep the big question to the last part three, which would be obviously in 3 weeks' time. Yes, the meaning of life, that is the big question. But we've got some big questions to consider before then. And we're going to literally think about some of the biggest philosophical questions and theories that have intrigued humanity for centuries. So whether you're a curious newcomer or a seasoned philosopher, I'm hoping these episodes will have something for you all. To begin with, let's explore what philosophy really is. At its core, philosophy is the study of the fundamental nature of knowledge, reality, in existence. It tackles those big questions and it forces us to think deeply about our beliefs, our values and the world around us. And what's really interesting is that a lot of scientific teams these days actually proactively go out and find someone who's got a philosophical bent about them to be part of the team, part of the research team, because philosophers tend to ask the questions because they're unbound by rigid rules and formulas and all the other kind of aspects that you would expect from a formal science background. They're not restricted by those kind of constraints, and therefore they're able to let their minds wander and wonder, which is the most important part, I think, of anyone in terms of asking those right kind of questions. So let's discuss the first question then that we need to raise. And it's about the idea of identity and continuity. And it's the ship of Theseus, which is the identity question. Now, if you're from the UK, you'll remember a classic TV comedy series called Only Fools and Horses. And there's a particular episode where Trigger, who's not the brightest tool in the toolbox, is part of a discussion between Del Boy and Rodney, and Del Boy is explaining that you need to look after your things, and Trigger comes out with this, oh yeah, he says it's true, he says, you see this broom, I've had this for 20 years and look at it, and it's like it's all in perfect nick. And then Trigger says, I've had to change the brush 5 times and the handle 7 times, but otherwise look at it, it's perfect. And everyone, it's like it's not the same broom, but is it? And this is where the ship of Theseus comes into its own. It's a thought experiment that questions whether an object that has had all its components replaced remains fundamentally the same object. It therefore explores themes of identity, continuity, and change. In lay terms, if you replace every single part of a ship over time, is it still the same ship? Or does it become something completely new? Now, the ship of Theseus is a classic thought experiment, raises loads of questions about that sense of identity and whether or not continuity of identity is really such a thing. It originates from a paradox that was first posed by the ancient Greek philosopher Plutarch. The scenario is simple yet profound. Imagine a ship that Theseus once sailed. Over time, every single part of the ship is replaced with new but identical parts. The question then arises, is it still the same ship? So the key questions and themes that this thought experiment raises is really profound. It's like, that, first of all, we need to consider the nature of identity. What constitutes identity? Is it the material components or something new and something more abstract? If each plank, nail and sail is replaced, can the ship still be called the ship of Theseus? You've then got the continuity of objects to consider. How does change affect continuity? The ship's structure, it's true, persists over time, even its matter does not. If continuity is maintained through the ship's form or function, does this actually then ensure that it remains the same ship? That's a great question. The third area that this thought experiment touches upon is the whole idea of physical and conceptual identity. So physical identity focuses on the actual components making up the ship, but the conceptual identity delves into the idea or essence of what the ship represents. The fourth area it looks at is applications to personal identity. So the ship of Theseus can be extended to us as humans and our sense of identity. When you think about it, our cells regenerate, our memories change, and experience continue to shape us. Are we still the same person over time? This leads to a lot of discussions about psychological continuity and the essence of the self. But there are lots of different philosophical interpretations of this thought experiment. So, for example, you've got, first of all, materialism. So a materialist might argue that once all original parts are replaced, the ship is no longer the same ship. But you've got then essentialism. An essentialist viewpoint might posit that the essence or form of the ship is actually what really defines its identity, regardless of any material changes. And then you've got four-dimensionalism, or as commonly known, temporally extended objects. So this perspective suggests that objects are extended into four dimensions, which includes, of course, time, length, breadth, depth, time. And the ship, therefore, is a series of temporal parts, making it both the same and not the same ship at different times. You've got the relativist view. So from a relativist standpoint, the identity of the ship could depend on the context or criteria that's set by observers, and that highlights the subjective nature of identity. Now, there are some modern day implications of all this, because with the rise of artificial intelligence and robotics, and the fact that components and software are constantly being upgraded, does a robot or AI system remain the same with all the parts replaced, or all the code replaced even? Even if the form and the structure and the application remains the same, if the code is completely changed or the parts are completely altered, does it therefore become something completely different? But there's also medical and biological questions that need to be asked. So consider organ transplants and the regeneration of human cells. Can an individual who has received substantial medical interventions still be considered the same person? There's a wonderful, fantastic lady that I know who's undergoing cancer treatment at the moment, where they are basically replaced her entire red blood count. I think that's right. I think that's what they've done. So there is nothing that was originally her blood in her system. And this raises that kind of question, doesn't it? Does it alter who she is as a person? Or does it alter how we should regard this person? So all this kind of really comes back into the real world. And this thought experiment really does challenge us to examine and redefine how we understand identity. It challenges the whole idea about what change and continuity actually means, and it provides a really rich ground for philosophical inquiry and practical application in various fields. Now, the second big philosophical question that I want to consider is really this whole idea of the nature of reality and Plato's allegory of the cave. Basically, this is the whole idea of what is real and how do we know it. And it touches on metaphysics, one of the core branches of philosophy. Plato's Allegory of the Cave explores the nature of reality and perception and enlightenment, because it suggests that our understanding of reality is limited by our experiences, and true knowledge only comes from understanding deeper truths that lie beyond the physical world and what we experience. So in lay terms, imagine living in a cave all your life, only seeing shadows on the wall and believing them to be the only reality. What would happen then if you stepped outside of the cave and see the real world? Plato's Allegory of the Cave, presented in his work The Republic, is a real, it's a really big metaphor that explores the nature of reality and human perception, because it challenges us to reflect on how we perceive the world around us and to question the limitations of our experiences. So let's take a deeper look. So the story goes in The Republic that Plato imagines a group of people who have lived chained in a dark cave all their lives, facing a blank wall. Behind them is the fire, and between the fire and the prisoners is a parapet along which puppeteers can walk. The prisoners cannot see the puppeteers directly, only the shadows they cast on the wall of the cave. So the prisoners mistake these shadows for reality, since they have never seen anyone else. All sounds a bit grim to me, but the key themes and interpretations that arise from that kind of thinking about these poor prisoners who have never experienced the real world all comes down to lots of different groupings around perception and reality. So let's say perception versus reality. The shadows on the cave wall represent the perception of those who believe empirical evidence, our senses, is the ultimate truth. It questions whether what we see and hear is the full extent of reality or merely a fraction of it. Enlightenment and ignorance are part of that, because when one prisoner is freed and exposed to the outside world for the first time, he experiences a sense of enlightenment. So initially the light of the sun might be blinding, but it represents the pain and struggle associated with gaining true knowledge. And this symbolizes the philosopher's journey from ignorance to enlightenment. But it also touches upon the idea of resistance to change. The prisoner who leaves the cave and sees the real world realizes that the shadows are mere illusions. However, upon returning to the cave to inform the others, he's met with resistance, with disbelief, hostility. And this reflects how individuals and societies can be resistant to change and reluctant to accept new truths that disrupt their established beliefs. You only need to think of Galileo to realize that this is the truth, basically. People do not like anything that challenges the status quo, especially people in power. So the philosopher's role in this is what Plato suggests, is that philosophers are like the free prisoners, seeing beyond the superficial to understand deeper truths of existence. However, he also acknowledges the challenges then that they face in educating and enlightening others who are still imprisoned by their perceptions. I mean, it's kind of like the modern interpretation of this is social media and the fact that it feeds a particular belief set, and then you actually get confronted by something that is a wider truth, shall we say, or a deeper truth. And the people and the person that have been so tied up in this one particular set of core beliefs that are presented by Facebook, for example, they really do violently, in some cases, resist what they're being told. They just will not accept it. It's fake news. I mean, this allegory of the cave, it really is significant today, particularly in this age of information, because it prompts us to critically evaluate the sources of our knowledge and the possibility that our understanding of reality may be incomplete or distorted by media, technology and social constructs. It encourages continuous questioning, learning and openness to new ideas, key traits for personal growth and societal progress, and something that certain authority types just squashing the ability of people to be able to ask questions. It's just frowned upon, it's pushed away, it's resisted, it's shouted down. And people have started to learn that actually raising your hand above the parapet and asking a question is a surefire way of getting shot. It's just a crazy world. And I don't mean, you know, really shot, although in some cases I suppose it could be. I mean, just in terms of the way that you are then castigated and pushed down for raising a particular kind of question. Now, the final one that I want to consider in this part of the three-part series on Philosophy 101 is the whole idea of Descartes' consciousness and self-awareness, the cogito ergo sum, I think, therefore I am. It's one of the most famous statements, but it's one that also raises so many questions that when you just say, people don't really think about what it really means. So we're going to analyse this. So that famous dictum, I think, therefore I am, René Descartes basically uses this statement to assert that the act of thinking is proof of one's existence. It's a fundamental element in any discussion that you can have about consciousness and self-awareness. So in lay terms, what it really gets down to, if you want to take Occam's razor to it and really cut it back, it means that even if everything around you is an illusion, the fact that you can doubt and think proves that you certainly do exist. The statement is pivotal in the history of philosophy as it forms the foundation of Descartes' argument for the existence of self and of consciousness. So Descartes embarked on a journey of skepticism that was really step by step, method by method. He really doubted all that could possibly be doubted to establish a ground of certainty. It sounds like a contradiction, but he basically did that. He doubted all that could possibly be doubted to establish a ground of certainty. He proposed then that while we can deceive ourselves about the external world's existence or the reliability of our senses, the very act of doubting or thinking indicates the presence of a thinking entity. Hence, even in the face of extreme scepticism, the existence of the thinking self, i.e. I, is indubitable. Now, in many ways, that statement, I think, therefore I am, it serves as a cornerstone for modern Western philosophy. It really underscores the shift to subjectivity, and it emphasises, I think, the importance of the individual's internal perspective and rational thought as the starting point for knowledge. This move, it paved the way, really, for modern notions of consciousness and self-awareness, and it asserts that thought itself is evidence of one's existence, as we said. This gets us to really start to look at how we understand consciousness. It sparks debates on the very nature of consciousness itself, because according to Descartes, consciousness is intrinsic and self-validating. By recognizing that even if one is being deceived or is dreaming, the act of thought itself confirms one's existence. Therefore, consciousness is perceived as an inherent attribute of the self-aware individual, and it highlights, this is the key thing, it highlights the capability of introspection and self-reflection. Now that has implications as well for self-awareness, because the philosophy emphasizes a dualist perspective where the mind and body are distinct entities. Through I Think, Therefore I Am, he sets the stage for deeper inquiries into self-awareness, because self-awareness then becomes the acknowledgement of one's own existence in internal states, and this gets validated through the act of thinking itself. So it becomes this self-fulfilling prophecy, if you want, where the thought creates the reality, and the reality creates the thought, and I therefore must exist because I am thinking about the fact that I may not exist. So that it's just such a brilliant argument. And it's just the foundation upon which individuals, therefore, can build their knowledge about themselves and their reality. So Descartes' work significantly influenced later philosophers and discussions on the nature of self and consciousness, and his ideas prompted further exploration into how we know what we know. which is the essence of the thinking self, and the division, therefore, between mind and body. Philosophers like Immanuel Kant and David Hume and contemporary cognitive scientists have continued to delve into these themes, and it questions and expands all the time upon Descartes' initial claims. So in conclusion, I think, therefore, I am encapsulates a profound insight into consciousness and self-awareness, and this asserts that the very capacity for thought itself therefore confirms your existence. This principle establishes a basis for understanding the self, separating the thinking entity from the external world, and it emphasizes the primacy of internal cognition in the pursuit of knowledge. Now, we'll look more into that particular philosophical question next week when we consider AI and the idea of life itself later in this series, in part 3. I think we will be doing a real in-depth look at the whole meaning of life and consciousness with the rise of AI and robotics. But I hope this first part has got you really thinking about just what is the reality that we perceive. Is it really what we see? Is there more that we should be trying to find out about anything that is presented to us? And I think too many people, unfortunately, in this world, want an easy answer, they want an easy ride, and they want to be told what to believe, especially if what they're told to believe matches what they want to believe. This is why there's all this rise of populist, so-called populist groups, and the QAnon and all this kind of material that gets propagated and repropagated constantly, conspiracy theory after conspiracy theory, and attack after attack after attack on certain groups of people. And it's become insidious within our society that we don't ask questions. We don't question what we are presented with. I would love nothing more than to know that people have listened to this episode, have gone out to find pieces of work and articles, or even bought books from that have some of these philosophical questions in them, and also to look and see if there's any counter views that are out there or counter interpretations from the ones that I've presented just on these three questions alone. Now, next week we're going to consider a couple of more big questions, including ethical ones like the trolley problem. So come and join me for that next week. In the meantime, I hope you've enjoyed this one. And I've got some of these books that I've referred to, and at least one of them I haven't read. The David Hume book I haven't read. I'm going to make that a priority for next week. But in the meantime, everyone, keep thinking. Please keep asking questions. It's so important. Encourage everyone in your family, in your team, in your work, everyone to ask questions. We need to get over this idea that questions are somehow wrong, that we shouldn't question what we're being given. It's just the reason why the world is in the mess it's in is because we've stopped asking questions. And I think we need to start to, as individuals and as communities and as societies, we need to start resisting this idea that those above us know best. And we need to start thinking for ourselves and asking the questions that will help us find solutions to the kind of problems that the world is facing. So take care, everyone, and I'll see you next week for part 2 of Philosophy 101. Keep on thinking.
If you would like to find out more, or join in with the conversation, our forum has a corresponding post for you to comment in. Simply go to darreninform.com/thinkworksforum and join in the fun. Or you can join the Facebook page by searching for @DarrenInform for news, tips and other helpful strategies. The show was hosted by Darren Smithson, and the music is by Alexander Nakarada. You have been listening to Think Works, the podcast for thinkers.